This week, we come to consider the Parsha of Bo and Yitzias Mitzrayim occurs in no uncertain terms. The concepts of our Parsha, Pesach, Yitzias Mitzrayim are all intimately bound up together. And I wanted to take the opportunity, specifically from the vantage point of a Shir on the Chumash, to have a look at certain Inyone Pesach from the Psukim. Often, as Pesach approaches, we are somewhat preoccupied, and in-depth analysis of the Psukim does not always lend itself. But all the more reason to do so on the occasion of Parshas Bo. And the first item that I wanted to take a look at is ownership of chametz, what is colloquially known in English as bali roye bali motze, which is four words and means not to own chametz. And let us see the one of the sources in the Parsha which discusses this, and that is in Perek Yud Beis, Pasuk Yud Tes. Perek Yud Beis, Pasuk Yud Tes. And the pasuk reads as follows: Shivas Yomim, for 7 days, or for a 7 day period, more accurately, Seor, leaven, representing chametz, Lo Yimatze Bevateichem, shall not be found, shall not be present in your houses. This is the first time we hear of the prohibition against owning chametz. Interestingly, to read the pasuk to the end may give us further insight into this prohibition. The pasuk continues, Ki kol ochal machmetzes, for anyone who eats chametz, v'nichrasa ha'nefesh ehim yadas Yisrael, that soul will be cut off from the congregation of Israel, bager uve'ezrach ha'aretz. So that's very interesting, because the pasuk begins by stating the prohibition against owning chametz, and then says, for one who eats chametz will be cut off. Karas, as we know, eating chametz is very severe prohibition. But as we've discussed, mentioned in the past, there are those who see within this pasuk the idea that the prohibition of the Torah prohibition against owning chametz is a protective measure against the more severe Torah prohibition of eating chametz. We are familiar with protective measures against transgressing prohibitions as being in the province of the Rabbanon. What are we told in the beginning of Pirkei Avos? Asusi Agla Torah, make a protective measure, and this the Rabbanon did, as we know. We're less familiar with the Torah making a prohibition for its own prohibitions, those that are considered to be particularly sensitive. The Torah will itself protect you from them by giving an additional prohibition. In this instance, as the Torah says, because the penalty for eating chametz is kares, very severe, it also exists only for 7 days, so bread is not something that we are naturally recoil from or have any type of feeling against. Therefore, put those two together, the Torah thus says you cannot even own it, because if a person eats it, the consequences are so dire. This is a concept which is called siyag min haTorah, a siyag from the Torah. We're familiar with siyag la Torah. The rabbi is making a protective prohibition for the Torah, but here the Torah itself makes a prohibition, siyag min haTorah, certainly one for the books. And the Abarbanel and others see this as the simple meaning of an understanding of our pasuk. But in addition to the prohibition of owning chametz, as we know, and Pesach in a sense really begins the night before, when we conduct the search for chametz, bedikas chametz, and we make a bracha. And the question is, where does bedikas chametz come from? There are certain opinions among the Rishonim, Rashi, and the Ran, in Maseches Psachim, that the requirement to search for chametz is min haTorah. It is a Torah prohibition to search the house for chametz, so that a person shouldn't transgress the prohibition against owning chametz. Yet here, Many Mefarshim raise a simple question. The Torah prohibition is one is not allowed to own chametz, and hopefully one doesn't. But how does that lead to the additional Torah requirement to search for chametz, to make sure that you don't own? What if a person is reasonably sure by themselves that they don't own? Do they still need to check? And if so, where does that come from? They're not owning chametz. The additional step of checking, where do we see that that is also from the Torah? And here we find a classic comment of the Meshech Chochma. And he directs our attention to the Gemara in Maseches Pesachim, in Daf Zayin, which actually learns from a string of psukim the idea of bedikas chometz, the concept of lo yimotze, and so on. And it goes to a number of places in Tanakh where the idea of things being found are discussed. And one of these places is actually from the weekly Parsha about a month ago, the end of Parshas Miketz, where the cup was hidden in Binyamin's sack, and then they all unloaded all of their containers, and the Pasuk says, Vayichapes, he started searching in all the bags, Vayimatse HaGavia, and the cup that he was looking for was found in Binyamin's sack. This is one of the psukim which form the pillars of our understanding of our relationship with chametz. But what do we see? We see there that the concept of finding is stated and framed in terms of the result of looking for something. Because he searched for it, he found it. And that being the case, as Meshech Chochma, what do we see? The definition of something being found is something that is searched for and found. But if that's true, then when the Torah now says that it shouldn't be found, and of course there's many ways for the Torah to say you shouldn't own chametz, but the Torah says it shouldn't be found. But if the concept of finding presupposes looking for it and then it's found, so if the Torah says it may not be found, that means it may not be found even if you look for it. But how do you know that it won't be found even if you look for it, unless you look for it and don't find it? In order for a person to be sure that he has fulfilled the Torah's injunction of it should not be found, you can only be sure that it won't be found by searching for it and not finding it. And that is the source in the Torah for Bedikas Chometz, to conduct the search, so that when you finished and you didn't find it, you have fulfilled entirely the concept of Lo Yimatse. Classic comment of Meshech Chochma directly from the Pasuk, cutting into that dispute among the Rishonim about Bedikas Chometz. It's apropos to mention, with regards to searching and finding, as we know, in our time, Bedikas Chometz, I would say, after the Rebbetzins finished cleaning the house and the husband has finished not getting in the way, woe to anyone who finds a piece of chametz anywhere in the house. The house has been chametz-free for often since Hanukkah. And if that's the case, then the poskim begin to wonder, what exactly are you looking for? In a sense, you could say you've already checked. And this is one of the reasons why there is a time-honored minhag of hiding or putting down small pieces of chametz, so that in a sense, there will always be what to find. And this now becomes a major part of Bedikas Chometz, certainly in some households. I think it's fair to say for some people, by the time the Afikoman comes and they're searching for that, a day and a bit later, they are well-versed in every nook and cranny and conceivable hiding place within the house. They were trained 10 times over in Bedikas Chometz. Now, the Shaila is, what value is there, or what merit is there in searching for something that has been placed there intentionally? And even if it's someone else who put the chometz down, and the one who's searching doesn't know where it is, but the one who put it down knows where it is, So is this a search? Are you, to search for something that you know where it is, is there any meaning to that? And there are those who raise this question because that seems to be what's happening. But there is a classic response to this in the Shelus Utshuvas Dovev Mesharim. The Dovev Mesharim, the Chabina Rav, one of the greats of Yerushalayim, said that actually one can find support for this idea as well in that pasuk about Binyamin. After all, what does the pasuk say? And this is one of the psukim that give us the foundations for Bedikas Chomet. He searched for the cup and he found it. Who searched for the cup? The one who hid it. It's Menashe. He, in this original case of searching and finding, the one who is described as Vayichapes, he searched. Vayimatze, and it was found. It was found after the search of the one who put it there in the first place, and still it's called Vayichapes Vayimatze, and therefore says the Dovev Misharim, the Chabina Rav, there's ample basis for this time-honored minhag of even those who put it down. They know where it is. Someone knows where it is. Nonetheless, this is part of the way that Bedikas Chometz comes to be performed. I will mention just before we move on, the story is told of the rabbi who received a phone call on Erev Pesach. It was the night, it was 8 o'clock at night. This woman, she says, we're in the middle of Bedikas Chometz, we put down 10 pieces, my husband has only found 9. What should we do? And the rabbi says, one really should find all 10. I mean, it's only 8 o'clock. I feel bad to tell you to keep on searching, but it really should be done. And so she says, thank you. An hour later, she calls back and says, we still haven't found the final piece. What should we do? The rabbi says, it's 9 o'clock, but really, if possible, it really should be done. The phone is silent until at 12 o'clock at night. The phone rings again, and it's the woman and says, I'm sorry, Rabbi, my husband still has not found the 10th piece, and just please, can you tell us what to do? And the rabbi says, I'm not sure how to advise you. I mean, it's 12 o'clock, but is there any way that it could be found? To which the woman said, well, can I give him a hint? So, every house with their customs for Bedikas Chometz. In the meanwhile, back to our parsha. So we discussed a bit about Bali Motze, owning Chometz, and Bedikas Chometz, the search for Chometz, again, all from the Psukim. But now let us come to discuss another central part of Pesach, which is, of course, Matzah. And the mitzvah of eating Matzah, there's more to it than that, and important to know that it comes from the Pasuk. Perek Yud Beis, we're still in Perek Yud Beis, so many of the halachas are in this Perek. Pasuk Yud Zayin. Perek Yud Beis Pasuk Yud Zayin begins with the famous words, Ushamartem es ha-matzos. You shall guard the matzos. And what does this mean? It means exactly what it sounds like it means, and more. That is to say, the matzah needs to be guarded, of course, protected and guarded, that it should not become chametz. That means that the concept which is called shmura matzah, matzah shmura, certainly for the Seder night, is an absolute Torah requirement. If a person has a matzah that for some reason one knows was not guarded, even if you're pretty sure there was no chametz, but it's not acceptable for the actual mitzvah of eating matzah on Seder night, it needs to be actively guarded with intent that no chametz should, that it shouldn't become chametz, and so on. And moreover, not only does it need to be actively guarded, part of the Torah requirement is that it needs to be guarded l'shem mitzvah. Not only be sure that there was no chametz, but whoever is doing that needs to be done lishma, what's called, for the sake of the mitzvah, and that is also critical to fulfilling the mitzvah on Seder night. And it is for this reason that children, for example, are not qualified to bake matzah. They may know how to bake, but because what they're missing is what is known as da'as, that is to say, the awareness of the significance of things, either that they do or things that happen, that much is missing, even a bright child. an intelligent child, he may know all the halachas of matzah. But that element is missing, and therefore a child is not qualified to bake matzahs. They cannot have that kavana l'shem matzah. And as we know, so it needs to be someone who's already an adult and so on. Interestingly, we also know that regarding the question, from what stage does this guarding need to happen? Is it only from the actual baking or is it beforehand? There is a firm basis for being machmir, for being more stringent, and requiring the guarding already, either from the time of grinding the wheat, or even earlier than that, reaping and cutting the wheat in the first place. That is a well-established position. However, it was known over the generations that that was often left to people that couldn't really do these things lishma. Non-Jews would be able to do that, a Jew would be supervising, but that was considered acceptable. And the question is, how can we have it both ways? If we say that part of what needs to happen as you prepare the matzah, it needs to be prepared with intent, with lishma intent. And we know that a minor doesn't have that intent. A non-Jew doesn't have that intent. Well, if you pull that back to requirement to the earlier stages, why is it acceptable for a non-Jew to do all those things and just to have a Jew to supervise? And this question is discussed by the Chasam Sofer. And all of this is brought by Rav Asher Weiss, who then has his own additional formula. But the key to all of this, says Chasam Sofer, what is incorrect, or certainly not necessarily correct, is to say that matzah needs to be baked lishma. That is not so. The Torah never says you shall bake matzahs lishma. By point of contrast, when a person makes tzitzis, spinning the thread, that does need to be done lishma. The action needs to be performed lishma, because it says ve'osu lahem tzitzis. It needs to be done l'shem mitzvas tzitzis. The Torah never says, after all, baking is to matzah what spinning is to tzitzis. But the Torah never said you shall bake it lishma. It says ushmartem es hamatzos. You know what needs to be done with intent for the sake of the mitzvah? Guarding the matzah. The question is it possible for one person to be doing the actions and interacting with the wheat and the flour and so on, who doesn't have lishma capacity, but someone else is there who's doing the guarding, and he does have lishma capacity? Is that acceptable? Well, here we come to the difference between what does it mean to guard grain when you're reaping it, and when you're grinding it, and what does it mean when you're already kneading it? There's a basic difference between them. As long as you're grinding and reaping, there's no water there. And the goal is to ensure that no water gets there. It doesn't have to be the one who's doing the reaping or the grinding that looks out for that. The water will come from without. And someone else can be there guarding, lishma. So you can have a non-Jew who's cutting or grinding, and then the Jew is doing the shmira. Because ushmartem is hamatzos, it's the guarding that needs to be done, lishma. All of that changes when you enter the final stage of the kneading. At that stage, it's not correct to say that you should protect the matzah from any water coming into contact with it. Water's already come into contact with it. It's dough. You're kneading it now. Which means the form of guarding will actually take place by the one who's involved with it, making sure that they're constantly moving it and kneading it and so on, so that it doesn't become chametz. At that stage, the action of preparing the matzah and guarding the matzah, they become fused. They become inseparable. You cannot have a situation where one person is doing the kneading, which really is the form of guarding it from becoming chametz, and someone else is from the outside, is guarding. At that stage, the final stage of kneading and beyond, it can only be the one who's handling it. And therefore, says Chasam Sofer, you understand why in the earlier stages, it's possible to separate the guarding and the involvement. So a non-Jew can do the activities, a Jew can do the shmira. But once you get to the kneading, not a non-Jew, not a minor, it's got to be the person himself who's doing it. So all of this comes from paying attention to something we take for granted. Even though we're familiar with the term shmura matzah, we might never put the two together, and we know that matzahs need to be done the shma. We might never pay attention to what is it about the matzah, which aspect of the matzah needs to be done the shma. Not the making per se, the guarding. At a certain point, the guarding and the making will become one, namely at kneading. And this, of course, leads in perhaps more closer to our times to the matter, just to mention it, although it's, of course, a full-blown discussion, the issue of machine matzahs. Because one takes all the ingredients, puts them in, presses the button, and that's that. Hopefully it doesn't go away, but that's the end of one's involvement. So the first question is, when a person presses the button, are they considered to be doing everything that the machine does? That's all considered to be their activity? If it is, then that's perfectly acceptable because they are doing everything and they have their intent. Press the button, l'shem mitzvas matzah, and everything else is your doing. But not everyone looks upon the act of a machine as considered the act of the one who pressed the button. Maybe it's just a grammar, a cause. But if it's not your act, does that mean machine-made matzos are not acceptable? Says Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, not necessarily. Once we remember again that the Torah never requires you to make matzos lishma, you only have to guard matzos lishma. If someone else is involved, they're doing the guarding. But if you put it into a machine, and the machine, we assume, follows your instructions, so then you're still guarding it as the machine is going through those motions. The machine is not going to change its mind, and therefore, it's in a sense, it is in a guarded state as the machine is doing the work. Of course, it's possible for the machine to malfunction. It's also possible for a person to malfunction. But within the normal range of things, there are those who are inclined, unlike tzitzis, and again, this contrast comes back. If tzitzis need to be made lishma, and the machine isn't your action, then machine-made tzitzis would not be acceptable. But even if that's true, machine-made matzah could yet be acceptable because unlike tzitzis, you don't have to bake it lishma, you need to guard it lishma. So these are some of the highlights. And again, it's nice to discuss these things somewhat prior to the time when things will get busy and it's more the practicalities that will take over to appreciate the fundamentals. And moreover, again, how it all comes from the psukim. And I believe there's room, just as a PS to this part of the discussion, to say something more. And that is, if we go back to the pasuk, again, we are in pasuk Yud Zayin. And pasuk Yud Zayin begins with the three words, Ushmartem es ha-matzos, you shall guard the matzos, which we spoke about just now for a few moments. But it's interesting to consider how the pasuk continues. What does it say? Ushimartim es ha-matzos, guard the matzos, ki be'etzem hayom hazeh, hotzeis yes tzivoseichem me'eretz Mitzrayim. For on this very day, I took you out from Mitzrayim. Once again, the word ki is there, and ki means because, meaning the pasuk proceeds to give an explanation. It sounds like the explanation for the requirement to guard the matzos is because be'etzem hayom hazeh, hotzeisi, I took your hosts out of Mitzrayim. I took all of your number out of Mitzrayim. How is that an explanation for the requirement to guard the matzos? I wonder whether we may suggest the following. Be'etzem hayom hazeh, as Rashi will tell us later on, means at high noon, meaning in the middle of the day. And why is that so significant that the Jewish people left in the middle of the day? Because, as we know from Rashi and from Chazal, no one should say that we somehow stole away, or the Egyptians, if only they knew, they would have stopped us. It needs to be manifestly clear that the Jewish people are leaving for one reason and one reason only, or as a result or due to only one thing, and that is Hashem's intervention to take them out. No one can stop that. So in other words, something that might be ascribed to other factors, they're all negated by us leaving at that time where there's no one who doesn't know about it and no one did anything about it. That's called Be'etzem Hayom Hazeh, in order that the nature of what's happening is absolutely clear. Perhaps, therefore, one may suggest that this is what results in a special requirement on matzah. It needs to be guarded lishma, with intention. As if to say, it's the same theme of intentionality that resulted in us leaving at that time so that it is unambiguously clear as to what is happening here, so too does that lead now to active intent as to what this dough is being baked for, to matzah, for the sake of the fulfillment of matzah. So I wonder whether the presence of intent and clarity and manifestation there is really what links the two, as the pasuk itself links the two, as it presents Be'etzem Hayom Hazeh as the background and explanation for Ushmartem Es HaMatzos. Well, so far we've spoken about chametz and bedikas chametz, we've spoken about matzah. Let us move on now to another central mitzvah of Pesach, which for us, until further notice, is more the subject of study than consumption, and that is Korban Pesach. And I'd like to present an analysis and an approach to Korban Pesach, which is simply out of this world, and it comes, not surprisingly, from Reb Leib Mintzberg in the Sefer Ben Melech. And he prefaces in the following way. He will raise a question that we might find quite surprising until we hear the answer. The background to the question is as follows. In the world of korbanos, assuming that a person hasn't done something wrong, but everything is good and a person is bringing a korban, so we are familiar with two categories of korban. In a sense, they're two worlds. And they are a korban ola, which we call a burnt offering, and a korban shlamim, what's called a peace offering. And of course, they have a great deal in common. They're both korbanos, etc., and performed by a kohen. But we already know that, for example, an ola is consumed entirely by the mizbeach. That's why it's called an ola. The whole thing goes up, heavenwards. Nothing is consumed by anyone, not a kohen, and not a yisrael, and not anyone. A shlamim, on the other hand, actually is consumed by everyone, meaning there are certain parts that are offered on the Mizbeach, the sacrificial parts, some is given to the Kohen, most of it is actually eaten by the owner and whoever he cares to invite to partake of the Korban with him, so it's spread around a lot more. And Rav Mintzberg explains that these two types of Korbanos, these two categories, they really reflect two aspects of our connection with Hashem, which really has a duality to it. On the one hand, there is the element, of course, of avodah, its service, its worship, its recognizing Hashem as the primary existence, and all that goes with that fealty. On the other hand, as we know, alongside that aspect of our relationship with Hashem, as Avdei Hashem, servants of Hashem, we're also children of Hashem. And there's an element of love and warmth. And these two types of korbanos really accentuate and emphasize these two aspects of our relationship. The korban ola represents the avodah aspect, the subjection aspect. And that is why it all goes onto the mizbeach. It's everything's offered up, everything's nullified, everything is ascends heavenward. Whereas the shlomim, as its name suggests, shlomim is peace. It's about the shalom, it's about the shalom that exists between us and Hashem. And it's a positive feeling, Hashem's love for the Jewish people, their love for him. Some is put on the Mizbeach, some goes to the people, and they share the Korban, so to speak. But that's what's happening. It's a very interesting way of seeing these two types of Korbanos. They really relate to these two aspects of our relationship with Hashem. And this now leads us, after that background, this leads us to ask the question, what about Korban Pesach? To which category does it belong? Is it like a Korban Ola, which is more avoda-based, divine service-based, or is it like a Shlame, which is more love-based and relationship-based? And as we will see, the answer to this question is somewhat blended. It is a composite situation. And how do we see that? The first thing we need to know about a Korban Pesach is that it is an exception to the rule. Because, generally speaking, korbanos are brought from female animals. Chatos will be from female. Shlamim from female. The exception is Ola. Of all the categories of korban, the others are brought from female animals. Ola is brought from a male. Okay. What are the implications for Korban Pesach? Korban Pesach is a male animal, either a male sheep, a male goat, setamim, zachar, ben shana. That already, on its most basic determining coordinate, categorizes it together with Ola. It's like an Ola. This is a male korban. Having said that, one cannot help but notice that not all of the Korban Pesach goes on the Mizbeach. Most of it is eaten. And not only is most of it is eaten, there is a mitzvah to eat from the Korban Pesach, and it is a separate mitzvah of Taryag, to eat from the Korban Pesach. That's highly unusual for an Ola. That sounds a lot like a Shlamim, right? It can be eaten anywhere in Yerushalayim, just like a Shlamim. So how do these two go together? It seems to be emerging by just from its basic halachas as a composite korban. It's like a blend between an ola in terms of its gender, a shlamim in terms of what happens to it. How are we to understand that? We're normally familiar with one or the other. Why would they combine? But the truth is, says Ibn Melech, that they do combine. Because even though it's true, if one lahavdil could borrow from our own working experience, once a person enters a certain position which involves certain duties and responsibilities, at that point on, their focus is their duties and their responsibilities. But when they enter the position, isn't it true that if it's a significant position, it's accompanied with often a form of celebration which emphasizes all of these other relationship aspects of what they're doing? Welcome to the firm, Lahavdil. Now, by this time tomorrow morning, no one is welcoming you to the firm anymore. It's to work. That may well be. But the entry, that's a meeting point of these two elements. Korban Pesach is our entry into Avodah of Hashem. It's the very first korban that we ever brought. And therefore, while in future times, from this point onwards, an Ola is Avoda, and it's pure Avoda, with all that represents, yes. But on day one, if the Avoda cannot help but see the Shlomim element, the love of what it's all about, and so on, leads into this Korban. And therefore, it becomes an amazing situation. It's an Ola, part of which is eaten. And what is Hashem saying? Welcome to Avoda. It's a special occasion. And not only is this true for the original Korban Pesach, it is true for every subsequent Korban Pesach, because every Korban Pesach is a re-entry into Avoda. That's why a person cannot ever miss even one Korban Pesach. One can't say, I brought last year. It's a renewal every year. And because it's a renewal, it has this element every year. And that means that Pesach, one could say, is the Rosh Hashanah of our service of Hashem. But because that's the case, it's also the Rosh Hashanah of initiating our relationship with Hashem. All of this finds expression within the Korban Pesach. And that is a very unique situation. You find the trappings of an Ola with the parameters of a Shlamim, and it goes together. And the truth is, the matter goes further. Why? But just to corroborate this point beforehand, there is a short phrase from the Zohar which really accentuates this point. Normally, when people are allowed to partake from Korbanos, the Gemara describes that as they merit or receive these parts of the Korbanos Mishulchan Gavoa, from the table of on high. It's as if Hashem has apportioned to them from his table, from the Mizbeach, to them. So we are Zoche from Shulchan Gavoa. When it comes to Korban Pesach, the Zohar doesn't talk about us receiving the part of the Korban that we don't receive it from Hashem. The words of the Zohar are the achlin al pesura de avuhon. We eat at the table of Hashem. This is not mishloach manos. This is not Hashem allowing us to have some of it where we are. It's bringing us to Him. But what does that mean? It means that the parts of the flesh of the Korban Pesach that we eat should have gone on the mizbeach. This is an ola. This is avoda. So we are now fulfilling the role of the Mizbeach. The Mizbeach is Hashem's table. That's what it means for us to be dining at Hashem's table by eating the Korban Pesach. And the matter goes further. For what we've seen so far is that, generally speaking, an Ola, a burnt offering, none of it is consumed. It all goes on the Mizbeach. But when it comes to the Korban Pesach, it's an Ola in frame, but some of it's consumed by us instead of the Mizbeach. Does it ever go further? Says Rav Mintzberg, yes, once it did. The very first Korban Pesach. I think we get so swept up with Yetzias Mitzrayim, even the halachically minded among us may lose sight of exactly how the first Korban Pesach worked. It doesn't seem to have worked like any other Korban in history, in the sense that we know that when a korban is brought, so the blood is sprinkled on the Mizbeach, and there are certain parts of the animal that are offered on the Mizbeach, always, for any korban, those sacrificial parts, whether it's a shlomen, doesn't make a difference. But let's try and account for things as best we can. The original Korban Pesach, there was no Mizbeach. So firstly, where is the blood sprinkled? And actually, the answer to that is a discussion that we have had in the past. The Gemara says in Psachim Daf Tzadik Vav, the blood that was put on the doorpost and the lintel of the Jewish homes fulfilled the requirement of the sprinkling of the blood of the Korban. Their homes became like the Mizbeach in that respect, which is itself already an astounding thing. But there's something more astounding still, which we've never discussed. But the Gemara talks about it. What about the sacrificial parts? Where are you going to put them? The blood is normally sprinkled on the Mizbeach. That was put on the doorpost. What about the sacrificial parts from every single Korban that are put on the Mizbeach? Where did they go? And the Gemara says, we ate them. The parts that are kosher. It's not kosher, it's not kosher. But the parts that are kosher, that there is no Korban that they don't go on the Mizbeach, but that very first time, we ate them. But what does that mean? It means that on the first entry, the actual entry into the Avoda of Hashem, the ascension of the Jewish people was so great that they fulfilled the role of the Mizbeach entirely. Not just eating the flesh of the Korban, which would for an Ola would normally, eating the parts of a Korban that are never not brought on the Mizbeach. All of it was consumed by the Jewish people. That's historic occasion. The Jewish people have stepped in to take the form of the Mizbeach, because that's how close they are to Hashem. It's an amazing thing. So in summary, if we may portray this, and I hope the analogy is not ill-advised, there is a pyramid here. because on the most basic level of Ola, none of it's consumed by people. It all goes on the Mizbeach. And then as you move to the annual Korban Pesach, the meat is consumed by people, and the rest goes on the Mizbeach. But at the top, the apex, you had the original Korban Pesach, where nothing went on the Mizbeach, and whatever could be consumed was consumed by people. All of this is the picture that comes together from considering all of these aspects of a Korban Pesach, and I believe most profound to give us, again, we're currently lacking the actual bringing of the Korban Pesach, to appreciate what it represents. Those themes certainly are present on a yearly basis as we rededicate and rejuvenate our avodah relationship with Hashem. From here, let us move. We've discussed chametz, we've discussed matzah, we've discussed Korban Pesach. The time has come to discuss Pesach. And let us see how that is expressed in our parsha. We once again in Perek Yud Beis, towards the end, Pasuk Mem Beis. So let us see, Perek Yud Beis, Pasuk Mem Beis. And we're still with Rav Mintzberg. Rav Mintzberg explodes here in Parshas Bo. In addition to his running commentary to the Sukkim, he has 19 essays on Parshas Bo. So we've skipped judiciously, but there are certain can't-miss discussions. So Perek Yud Beis, Pasuk Mem Beis, describes Seder night as Leil Shimurim, a night of guarding, a night that's guarded, a night that's waited, and once again, very interesting, from Ushmarta Mesamatzah, Pesach itself has been, Hashem has been, so to speak, keeping an eye on Pesach. Leil Shimurim, as Rashi comments, already from the covenant between the pieces, the Bris Ben Abisarim, Hashem told Avram, they're going to come out on the 15th of Nisan. Leil Shimurim. It's the day that everyone has been waiting for. What year? That remains to be determined, as it was determined, but Avram was already told it will happen on the 15th of Nisan. And indeed, according to the Medrash Tanchuma, in Parshas Bo, the Bris Ben Abisarim itself took place on the 15th of Nisan. So it was literally to the day, however many years it was, 430 years. As our pasuk says, it describes us as being in Mitzrayim for 430 years. We weren't there physically for 430, but from the first time that Avram is told about it until we left, the shadow of Mitzrayim starts with the Bris Ben Abisarim until 430 years. So these two things, they bracket the whole thing, and they're all happening on Pesach. But they are not the only significant event that happens on Pesach. The Gemara says in Maseches Rosh Hashanah, and Daf Yud Aleph Amud Beis, that Yitzchak was born on Pesach. That's right. Avram has his famous hosting of the Malachim on Pesach, makes them ugos, then they matzos later on with Lot. A year later, Yitzchak is born on Pesach. Okay. So far the Medrash Tanchuma has told us that Avram's event of the Bris Ben Abisarim happened on Pesach, 15th of Nisan. Then the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah tells us that the birth of Yitzchak takes place on the 15th of Nisan. And what about Yaakov? Well, the Pirkei Rabbi explains, and Rashi cites this in Parshas Toldos, the day, or the night when Yaakov got the brachos from Yitzchak was Seder night. That's why he gave him those two gidayim, one for Korban Pesach, one for Chagigah, and there's much discussion about all of that. The Pasuk even says that he provided him with wine, if it's already Seder night, arba kosos, and so on, and all of the elements that are there. The question is, what is the significance of all of these events happening on the same day? Are they connected to each other? Says Rav Mintzberg, indeed they are. The background to all of this is related to a discussion that we had a couple of weeks ago, where we saw again through Rav Mintzberg, that the Jewish people are looked upon as a new element of creation. They've been personally, so to speak, formed and fashioned from within the world by Hashem. As the Pasuk says in Yeshaya, Am zu yatzarti li, I have fashioned this people, Hashem says about the Jewish people. These are not natural forces. In many respects, it is in spite of natural forces that the Jewish people emerge as Hashem's people. All of these events are key connecting events for the future of the Jewish people. In the Bris Ben Abesorim, that is when Avram actually moves from being the tzaddik that he is, and so on, and publicizing Hashem, to Hashem entering into a covenant with him. At this point, there is a pact that the Jewish people will come from Avram. Until now, there have been many things, assurances, promises, and of course, an assurance and a promise from Hashem is more than enough. But Hashem goes the extra step and enters into a covenant with Avram. And there begins now, in earnest, the forerunning of the Jewish people. This is now finds continued expression in the birth of Yitzchak. Yitzchak is the only son from Sarah, and he is the sole continuation of the Jewish people as they are being prepared. And therefore, the birth of Yitzchak is the entry of another. The birth of Avram is not the significant date. It's the entry of Avram into the Bris that's a significant date for the future of the Jewish people. The birth of Yitzchak, who enters from literally from the womb, also happens on this date of the 15th of Nisan. And when it comes to Yaakov, as unusual as it sounds, but we see this from many, many different places, Yaakov and Esav, at a certain point, it's not until Yaakov gets the blessings that it becomes absolutely clear and irrevocable that he is now the future of the Jewish people, he and only he. Which means, again, the birth of Yaakov and Esav, so many things are still possible. Maybe they'll both be part of the Jewish people. That's also a possibility, as far as the Medrash. If Esav had kept himself together and acted appropriately. But at this point, when Yaakov emerges as the sole progenitor for the what will become the Jewish people, that is a Pesach event, and it happens on Pesach. And all of this culminates in the Jewish people themselves being born as a nation on the day of Pesach, the 15th of Nisan. But what is the meaning behind all of this? This significant day for the Jewish people, where does that come from? But here too, we see that the month of Nisan is considered the first month as far as the Jewish people is concerned. The Torah calls it the first month. Tishrei will be called the seventh month. But why are there two calendars? Isn't a calendar appropriately dated back to the beginning? It is. But there's two beginnings. That's the full impact of the notion that the Jewish people are created. The creation of the world happens in the month of Tishrei. The creation of the Jewish people happens in the month of Nisan. And it's significant enough of an additional element of creation that it has its own calendar. And that is why the very first thing that the Jewish people are told in our parsha is the beginning of Perek Yud Beis. HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodeshim. Before we even told about Pesach, which is the 15th of Nisan. It has to be framed. It has to be couched. Set against the fact that this for you is the first month. In fact, what's very important to note here is that the significance of Pesach is primarily because it's in Nisan. Now it's true it's the 15th of Nisan. And the 14th and the 16th are not good enough. That's true. But it's the 15th because it is the apex. It's the high point of the month of Nisan. It's the best representation of this month. But in a sense, therefore, because it represents the month, that really tells us that Pesach is the festival of the month of Nisan. It's not, if it will be the 14th, or the 16th, it's not good enough Pesach-wise, but it's still Nisan. And Pesach still represents the month, this is at its height. And that is why we find that as alongside the specifications of the 15th, which are, of course, they cannot move, Pesach is Pesach, that night and only, but the Avodah is also referred to as taking place vis-a-vis the month. Moshe says to the Jewish people at the end of this week's parsha, in the parshas of Kadesh, Vayikra Yevi'echa, Perek Yud Gimel, He says in Perek Yud Gimel, Pasuk Hey, and this is after telling them earlier in Pasuk Dalet, in Perek Yud Gimel, Pasuk Dalet, Hayom Atem Yotzim, today you're going out, B'chodesh Aviv, in the spring month, that's Nisan. The day is defined by the month. You're going out today. When is today? Today is in the month of Nisan. That defines the day, by the month. And then the next pasuk, when it says, Vayaki Yaviyacha Hashem El Eretz Haknani, Chiti, Amuri, Chivi, Vayvusi, Shenishba Lavasecha, Lases Lacha, Eretz Avatz Chalav Dvash, when Hashem takes you into the land of Israel, V'avadata Es HaVoda HaZos, B'chodesh HaZeh. You should continue to perform this avoda. Which avoda? Korban Pesach. When does Korban Pesach take place? In this month. When in this month? Doesn't say. Well, now we know it's the 15th. But it doesn't say. Because here, what's being emphasized is that Pesach is in the month, which is the first month for the Jewish people. Now, we know that it's the 15th. It's been made abundantly clear. But it's not mentioned here. Because we're just showing just how much the month itself, this is our month, it's Rosh Chodeshim. And later on in Parshas Re'eh, we'll likewise be told about Pesach, Shomor es Chodesh Ha'aviv. Take care, guard. And once again, another Shomor. Shmartem es Hamatzos, Leil Shimurim, Shomor es Chodesh Ha'aviv. And by the way, with this in mind, the more we understand how, it's a nuanced point, but how the 15th of Nisan really represents the entire month of Nisan, I think it's easy to understand what we say famously in the Haggadah with regards to the mitzvah of telling the miracles of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Yochol Meresh Chodesh. One may have thought that this begins from Meresh Chodesh. Talmud Lomar. No. To that end, the Torah says, Vigal Talvincha Bayom Hahu. But if the Torah hadn't specified Bayom Hahu, I would have thought that you do it from the beginning of the month. Based on what? You know, when the Torah says to build a sukkah on the 15th of Tishri, I don't think anyone would have thought that you should start building it on Rosh Hashanah or Matzi Rosh Hashanah. Where does the Yochol Meresh Chodesh come from? It comes from the fact that here on Pesach, it's the Chodesh that's being represented. Now, it's never better represented by the 15th of Nisan, and in many respects can only be represented by the 15th of Nisan. But in terms of telling the miracles, one may have thought it really begins from the beginning of the month, because in the end, in a broader sense, it really is about the Chodesh HaRishon. And taking this one step further, as we move forward in history, we see that there are other key events in our history that also take place in the month of Nisan. We enter the land of Israel in the month of Nisan. And it's not on Pesach. We celebrated Pesach a few days later in Israel. But we entered on the 10th of Nisan. Once we understand that the month is significant, so the timing for why the 10th specifically is its own question, but the timing of Nisan is well understood. This is a major development within the national existence of the Jewish people. They've entered their land. When else but Nisan? And additionally, the setting up of the Mishkan took place, as we know, on Rosh Chodesh Nisan. As we're told in Chumash Shemos, and Vayikra, and Bamidbar. Once again, Mishkan, it's a major development. V'shachanti b'socham, that's what it's all about. When should that happen? When else would it happen? In Nisan, obviously. Now this would seem to leave us with one anomaly. What about the giving of the Torah? The Torah was given in Sivan. Torah is also of central significance. The Jewish people are not the Jewish people without the Torah. And that is an understatement. So why is that not in Nisan? Says Rav Mintzberg, the giving of the Torah is different for a simple reason. If something starts in Nisan and a progression begins, it can continue beyond Nisan because it's all part of that same process. The Torah is given in Sivan because it's given after the Omer count that begins on Pesach. As long as things can be traced back to Nisan, it can emanate further into the year. And therefore, since the giving of the Torah was a count out from Pesach, so it's still connected to Pesach, as the continuum keeps going into Sivan. And moreover, not only is Shavuos connected to Nisan, and therefore it doesn't need to be given in Nisan, the same should have been true for those two other things. The Mishkan also didn't need to be constructed in Nisan. Why? Because if things had gone as planned, then having moved from the original crucible of Nisan, as we move towards Shavuos, which now is part of that progression, the next stage in that progression should have been to make the Mishkan. Had we not made the Egel, so when Moshe came down with the Luchos on the 17th of Tammuz, the day after that we would have started making the Mishkan. And that would have been another step taking its cue and trace back to Nisan. From Nisan, we count towards the receiving the Torah. From there, we keep going. As long as things keep going in a continuum, they can all be rooted in Nisan, and they can happen at other times in the year. But because we disrupted things by making the Egel, once you made the Egel, what happens? Can you still build the Mishkan? Yes, but the Pesach connection has been broken. It's been disrupted. So what do you have to do? You have to start again. You have to begin again. Beginnings for the Jewish people happen in Nisan. And therefore it was deferred till Nisan. You've got to pick up again. Nisan is the time of the year where things start to happen for the Jewish people. If they start, they can continue. If they become discontinued, they have to start again. And when they do, it will be Nisan of the next year. And the same is true in a broader sense for the entry into Eretz Yisrael. It's amazing for us to consider that had we not had the disaster of the Meraglim, we would have entered, or the 9th of Av would have heralded our entry into the land of Canaan. Had the spies come back with positive reports, from that point onwards, we're poised to enter. And we would have entered in the month of Av. But we disrupted things again. The connection is broken. So now what? It's 40 years now. When you pick up, you have to start again. And where are you going to start? In Nisan. And thus we entered on the 10th of Nisan. And so we see from this grand sweep of Reb Leib Mintzberg, beginning with his explanation of Lel Shimurim, the 15th of Nisan, the month of Nisan, things that emanate from the month of Nisan, things that are disconnected from Nisan, will start again in Nisan. And we see how the timing on the one hand is very broad. The entire month of Nisan is a month of Geula for us, is a Rosh Hashanah for us. That pervades the entire month. Within that, the 15th of Nisan has special status. And within that, there are certain times within the 15th of Nisan. When did we leave? Be'etzem Hayom Hazeh, at a very specific point. So on the most detailed level, the timing is significant. On the broader level, the timing emanates out, continues to be significant. This is the picture that we come to appreciate from within the Parsha with regards to matters relating to the mitzvahs of Pesach and of Pesach itself. So there's plenty to think about. Much food for thought here, and we'll leave our deliberations, Mitzvah Hashem, until this time next week. All the best, and Shabbat Besoros Tovus, and a Shavuot Tov.